Hanover Research is proud to share with you the Grant Rants NIH series, an 8-part dive into the National Institutes of Health. Every other week, we will examine a different aspect of the NIH for grant seekers, including an overview of institutes and centers, the R series, fellowships and training grants, resubmissions, and more. Check out the Grant Rants podcast page for information on upcoming sessions and follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn. Have a question or topic? Email us directly at podcast@hanoverresearch.com. Welcome back to the NIH series. This is a Grant Rant special series that we'll be running over the course of 8 episodes. If you didn't catch it, go back and check out episode 1. Episode 1 kind of gives an overview of the NIH. We talk about the institutes and centers and about the different points of contact you may encounter when you are submitting your grant proposal. But today we're going to be talking about the R series. So my name is Mallory Waters. I'm the host, and I am very pleased to welcome back Tom Kuhn.
Hello, Mallory. Hello, all again.
So, Tom, today we're going to be talking about the R series. I think that the R series is the most common and the most sought after grant at the NIH. And when I talk about the R series, I mean the R01 specifically, but certainly there are other mechanisms within the R series. So can you kind of walk us through to get us started? What are the main R series opportunities?
Yeah, you're right, too. These R series, this is where really NIH is focused most prominently on investigators and proposals. This is where they spend the bulk of their dollars. This is where they're really incentivizing faculty and other experts and teams and groups and students to really bring together and bring to bear all of what they can do on the research side to improve health sciences understanding and healthcare delivery in the U.S. So the R opportunities, the mechanisms, basically stands for research. There are a number of them, as you suspect. I'm going to go and start with the R01. The R01 is the biggest up to 5 years, $500,000 a year plus indirect costs, investigator initiated proposal, probably in the federal space, save the DOD or DARPA and some other programs that are, you know, big centers and others. Single or small team investigator initiated awards are really seeing the apex in the R01. It's a program that's used to support a discrete, specified, circumscribed research project. It's the most commonly used grant program. Actually, there are no specific dollar limits unless it's specified in the FOA. Note that you do have to ask for permission for more than 500 or more in any given year. They're, like I said, generally 3 to 5 years. They're utilized by all the ICs. And these, as Mallory and I talked about in the previous session, have parent announcements, ones that require clinical trials, ones that allow for basic experimental studies, and one where clinical trials are not allowed. So these are the big behemoths. They are very competitive. They are investigator initiated. They used to be heavily dominated by experienced PIs, but in the last 10 or more years, NIH has really recognized and has assigned early stage investigator status and special instructions to reviewers. So if you know what you're doing, if you have a track record and you're published, you have preliminary data that is a strong rationale for a proposed study, you may be ready for an R01. If not, there are a number of other R mechanisms that not only can help you get there, but can help to further help you advance your career. But I want to be cautious, and we'll talk about this. These are not stepping stones necessarily, or neither is the R03. The next one we'll talk about, the NIH small grant program, just an opportunity to knock out a feasibility study and get some data and step into an R01. The small grant program, kind of like the R21 exploratory or developmental research grant, is really designed to give limited funding for a short period of time to support a variety of projects. These could be pilot and feasibility studies. They're oftentimes collection of preliminary data or secondary analysis of that data. They generally tend to be versus the R01, smaller, very self-contained research projects that really allow for the new development of a new research approach or a technology, et cetera. So they're about 2 years of funding. The direct costs are limited to about $50,000 per year, so very small in that regard. They're also not renewable, but notably they are used by about half of the NIH ICs. And this is in large part because the R03 is an important program for faculty working really to make sure that they've done the kinds of data collection, analysis, et cetera, that helps to validate their preliminary work. Whereas the R21, the NIH Exploratory or Developmental Research Grant, really encourages new avenues of exploration or development of research projects that are really supporting and are in the early stages of development and needs some kind of that kind of level of support. They're sometimes used for pilot and feasibility studies like the R03. They're 2 years of funding, but they're a lot more dollars, upwards of $275 for the combined two-year project. No preliminary data is required. However, we're going to almost always recommend that you utilize it. This is not an opportunity for you to go in not ready. This is an opportunity for you to, based on something that you've been doing, something that you've achieved, something that you've published, there's a new opportunity or a direction that you want to follow, and you need some funding and some time to get there. So again, not a stepping stone to the R01, but a really important mechanism for you to advance your work. And then the last R mechanism I'm going to talk about here, because there are some different ones, is really the R15. This is the NIH Academic Research Enhancement Award. There actually are two programs within the R15. There's the Area Academic Research Enhancement Award, and then there's, I'm forgetting the name.
REAP.
I'm forgetting.
REAP.
Yeah, I'm forgetting what it stands for, but basically it's Area the
Yeah, so the REAP is the Research Enhancement Award Program. So it's very similar. It's just kind of a little bit different. And the REAP is for the professional schools. So things like schools of chiropractor schools and kind of things like that, DO schools, things like that.
Yeah, exactly right. The area awards are really about undergrads moving undergrads into the biomedical workforce. And you're right, the REAP awards are about moving professionals into the biomedical workforce. So they're both about the same in terms of eligibility. These are programs for applicants who do not have a lot of NIH funding, and they're really designed to help you develop more of that capability. The direct costs are about $300,000 over the entire three-year project, so they're not particularly lucrative. However, they're very critical in terms of your ability to leverage specific NIH resources to achieve specific institutional enhancement capabilities for training. So notably, they're not at all stepping stones to other traditional research grants. These are capacity and institutional development capability and development programs. One interesting point is that they're renewable, and oftentimes they can be, for very productive faculty, somewhat career defining, in the sense that someone who's having the influence on the capabilities of their institution are looked on very favorably by NIH, because that track of getting more and more and a more diverse a diverse type of people into the biomedical workforce is a key priority for Congress and the NIH.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to dig in a little bit more on a couple things here, one of the great things about the R15 is that NIH recognizes that there are great researchers and there are great research projects happening at institutions that maybe have not been, the R1, massive research entities, and they understand that. And so the R15 is really geared towards these institutions that have not had, I think it's more than $6 million over the last, out of the last 4 to 7 years, four of the last 7 years, you can't have more than $6 million in funding from the NIH, because it's trying to give a leg up to, researchers and projects that are happening at these institutions, that don't have that, research, kind of bench that maybe some of the other larger institutions have. So that's why I like that, particular R opportunity. The other thing that I wanted to kind of highlight on here, and you definitely alluded to it and kind of spoke to it a bit, Tom, but when you're thinking about applying to the NIH, there's a lot of different things that you have to consider. One of which is, the institute and center, which we talked about in, episode one. And then here we're talking about the different R opportunities, and knowing that not every institute and center participates in every our opportunity. So you have to make sure that if you're submitting to a, specific opportunity. And this is why getting familiar with how these, you know, solicitations read is very important. One of the first things you'll see when you look at an opportunity is you'll have participating organization, which is going to be the NIH, and then right underneath it, it's going to say components of participating organizations. And that's going to list out all of the institutes and the centers that are participating as part of this opportunity. So if you're looking for an R21 or you're looking for an R15, whether that be through the parent announcement, which again, we talked about back in episode one, or through an RFA, then you're going to want to check to see and make sure that the institute or center that your research most likely fits with is going to be participating. So definitely want to make sure that you familiarize yourself not only with the institutes and centers and kind of where your research best fits, but also looking at how to understand what these solicitations look like and making sure that the solicitation that you've selected, whether that's an R03, an R21, an R15, whatever that is, that the institute is, you know, participating in that.
Yes, good advice. And at the end of the day, I think the one thing you take away from grants in general is you need to know your solicitation before you develop your concept, before you talk to your program officer, and absolutely before you apply.
Yep. So Tom, one thing I want to really focus on here is I want to talk about the R21, because there is a misconception, I think, when I hear from folks and when I talk to folks about, well, we're not ready for the R01, so we want to go for the R21. And that is really not what the purpose of the R21 is. Can you talk us through why the R21 should not be considered, you know, either a starter grant or a stepping stone to the R01?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it kind of encompasses the R03 too. I mean, the smaller and the exploratory grant programs are not necessarily designed to be stepping stones. And so while they look like, oh, I can get small amount of money, I don't need preliminary evidence, and I can get things done in a couple years that get me where I need to be for an R01, may not be accurate. And in lots of cases, there's a lot of nuances to it. So sometimes it's hard to flesh it out. But thinking about you asking this question, you know, on the R21 code is really intended to encourage exploratory and developmental research, right? By providing support at the early and conceptual stages of project development. So it's often used as a seed grant in this sense, in that it's designed to really help faculty, researchers, teams get more direction in terms of a new exploratory avenue. Like we talked about a little bit earlier, you may have done an amazing project and that may have elucidated different pathways for continued innovation. So the R21 projects are distinguished by being highly innovative, and they're driving this high risk, high reward model or principle that's characteristic of this activity code. This is where NIH is telling reviewers, researchers, if you've got a new approach and you need some feasibility dollars to get there, remember this is $275 over a couple years. So there's enough resources in there. With the basics of the R21, they really need to be distinct from those that are supported through the traditional R01, because they're not intended as the bridge between the training that you got and getting to a full, you know, independent investigator status with an R01. It does allow you to introduce new and novel scientific ideas and systems and tools and targets and even technologies that have the potential to really substantially advance biomedical research. And this could be both in terms of your project and more broadly towards the portfolio of research. And because preliminary data aren't required, you want to make sure that if you're applying to an R21 to generate preliminary data, that you're not trapping yourself inside of a 2-year window that's not going to give you enough time. And that's one of the things we hear back, both anecdotally and, you know, intellectually from reviewers and applicants, where especially if they were funded and they got caught in this window of trying to get things done and then they miss a year and they have to go to the R01 with almost a year and a half gap of funding, which can be detrimental to their work. And on the flip side, if you're a year and a half out from a previous application, the expectation from reviewers are going to be that there's a lot more that you've been doing in that year and a half. And so, you know, you may get stuck in the idea that you're once again behind the current amount of preliminary data you need. So if you misuse the R21 to do a small R01 type research project, you might find that those 2 years will catch you in an incomplete hypothesis-based problem. You won't have enough data generated or publications that can get you the kinds of preliminary data and indicators of productivity that you need to be successful in an R01. Also, because the purpose of the R21 is really exploratory. It's not necessarily designed to support hypothesis-based research, so it's not even the right direction in that regard to an R01, which is very hypothesis-driven. And you know, your R21 won't help you get to a better pay line with the R01. In fact, and this is particularly true of new and early stage investigators, the R01, if you're ready for it, already has those specialized instructions baked in, just like the R3 and R21 do. But no matter which funding opportunity you choose, as we'll say in almost every section, this is where having conversations with your program officer, reading carefully the solicitation, and really understanding where and how an NIH investment at a particular point in your field is the best investment for you to go after. A lot of faculty, for instance, might consider collaborating on an R01 to get the kinds of work they need done, and then go in on their own rather than going through an R21 or an R3. However, those are both very important and very effective mechanisms for helping you advance your career.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'm going to say it here. I'm going to say it. Listen, there's no limit to how many times we're going to talk about talking to your program officer. You know, one of the things that I tend to tell folks when I have, you know, clients who send me an R21 that they want us to look at is I'll say, did you have your PO yet? Especially with the R21. The R21 is meant to be high risk, reward research. And then they'll, you know, sometimes we'll have folks ask us, well, you know, doesn't this fit that? And the question is, well, we're not the experts within your field. You need to talk to the PO. And if the PO advises you to, you know, submit to the R21, then go for it. Then that's great. But the PO is going to be the person who's going to be able to tell you, you know what, this doesn't really sound like an R21. This sounds like a small R01. Maybe you should add another aim and, you know, expand this into an R01 or something like that. So it's always good to talk to your PO and make sure that, especially when it comes to the R21, you know, I just want to dispel any notion out there that this is a stepping stone to the R01, because it is just a completely different beast for all the reasons that Tom said and more. Which leads me to kind of talking about the R01. So, Tom, you know, is the goal for PIs to always, is the goal always going to be to eventually secure that R01?
I mean, I have to answer this one kind of yes, kind of no. In some ways, it's the apex. I mean, it is the apex grant at the NIH. But it's for mature projects that are hypothesis driven with absolutely impeccable preliminary data, including publications and preferably publications in high impact journals with your ability to cite. They're going to be looking carefully at the statistical design. They're going to be looking carefully at your power. This is where the biostatisticians will participate in the review panels. And gosh, if they don't believe that your project has the kind of integrity, none of the other reviewers will. In the reviews that I've been in, especially with PCORI, I'm not an MD, PhD, and so I don't do a lot for NIH. But a biostatistician who has concerns about your project design will basically doom your proposal. So, yeah, I mean, everyone's after the R01s. They're 5 years of support. They have a budget that reflects the costs that are really required to complete these big projects, especially in the case of clinical trials. We know that standing up and getting the membership and achieving the power functions are critical, expensive, laborious efforts. So if you have strong preliminary data supporting your hypothesis, you're able to make a significant and highly innovative impact on your field. And as NIH itself recommends applying for an R01. However, new investigators, when trying to determine whether to submit an R01 is a good idea, make sure you consider the following. Again, strong preliminary data that support the rationale, the hypotheses, and the rationale for your project. A strong rationale for the proposed study, both not only in the literature review and your preliminary evidence, but within the portfolio that the funder has. So you've got to really be on the cutting edge, even the bleeding edge of the cutting edge of what's happening in your field. And then do you have that proven track record of experience? Are you published? Are they in science, relative science or health science journals? And are they high impact? And are they being cited often? And in the case where collaboration is required, do you, and where you don't have that specific expertise, do your collaborators have the kinds of expertise to make sure that all of the needed skill sets, tools, background experience, analytic capabilities are really there to achieve the goals of the project? So yes and no. If you're not ready, absolutely not. And there are no stepping stones other than productivity, significant contributions to your field, and publications that disseminate that. So yes, when you're ready, no, when you're not.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, in the spirit of, you know, the more you know and the more information, the better. And this is going to vary depending on the institute and center, but, you know, take a look at the pay line if you're able to. So if the institute that you're targeting has published their pay lines, then, you know, take a look and see what the different pay lines look like. So for instance, for NIAID, which is the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the pay line for R01s for non-new PIs is in the 11th percentile. But for new PIs, so we're thinking early career, early stage, it's 15th percentile. So you get a little bit of a boost there if you're able to, you know, take advantage of being early stage. And, you know, we can talk about that a little bit later when we get to that episode. But, you know, do some research, you know, look at the Institute's website, take a look at, you know, what's available to you in terms of the tools and kind of the information, which we're also going to get to in one of our later episodes. But we talked about
clinical trials.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to say briefly, because episode 6, we go a lot into the NIH tools, the report and the reporter tools, even the matchmaker text search functions. But yes, you're absolutely right. Use these tools.
Mm-hmm. I hear from a lot of folks about clinical trials, and, you know, it's a big part of what NIH does. So can PIs do clinical trials within the R series? And if so, what are those mechanisms?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, the answer is yes. NIH institutes generally use two parent mechanisms for the R01 and even the R21. Like I said earlier, one that allows and one that does not allow clinical trials. So you've got to be under the right parent announcement. The one that allows usually requires them. As you know, determining the efficacy of interventions is critical to NIH because they're all about translating knowledge into practice. So about the only thing that these R mechanisms do not support are the planning activities for clinical trials, you know, developing study designs, the clinical protocols, the consent documents, even identifying collaborators and enrollment sites. That's because the reviewers really need to see that's being done effectively in any any research project, because without that, you're not going to be able to stand up the trial component that you need to do the proofs or the comparisons, et cetera. And so, yes, there are that clear paths between our series mechanisms that either allow or require or do not allow clinical trials.
Absolutely. And then before we move on and kind of, you know, close the chapter on the R series for today, you know, I do want to highlight that, you know, again, when you're thinking about your R opportunity, if you want to go for an R03 and, you know, you are in a certain institute, remember that not all institutes and centers participate or use these activity codes the same way. You'll have to take a look closely at the funding opportunity to see which ICs participate. What is the specific eligibility? Sometimes an institute may not, you know, use the parent announcement. So I know that NCI, the National Cancer Institute, is one of those that has their own solicitation. Sometimes they don't kind of follow. They're not signed on to the parent announcements. Make sure that you're really looking through that, and you know that, you know, just because you want to submit an R03 doesn't mean that you're going to be able to, depending on which institute and which center you're going to, you know, fit in.
Yep, good advice. Yeah, it's always important to drill down first and know your institute before you get into the specific funding mechanisms.
All right, well, I think that's it for the R series. If you haven't yet, check out episode 1, which gave that overview of the NIH, talking through some of those institute centers and the folks that you're going to encounter. And then tune in about 2 weeks for our next episode, where we're going to dive into fellowships and training grants. Keep listening.
See you then.